worker. It was infuriating, meanwhile, to admit that Madame Aubuchon's judgment in ordering me to take time off was probably sound. I was in pain. My wrist hurt steadily, exhaustingly. The throbbing in my neck was less reliable, but more frightening when it came. Even if the surgery went beautifully, I would need weeks to heal. And there was no denying that I was emotionally drained. I made it upstairs to my bedroom and was changing into my oldest jeans and a soft, dove-gray cardigan when a knock sounded at the front door. I frowned. One of my brothers stopping by for a drink on his way home from work? I peeked out the window, expecting to spot the blonde head of either Tony or Martin. It was Will Zartman. I had not seen him since we'd parted ways at National Airport on Friday. I swiped a brush through my hair and ran downstairs. Neither of us spoke right away. We stood a few feet apart, me in my front hall, just inside the door, Will still out on the front step. His hands were stuffed in his pockets, and on his face was the same mix of sheepishness and defiance that I remembered from the last time he'd shown up unannounced in the hotel lobby in Atlanta. "This is a nice surprise. I would have changed if I'd known you were coming." I tugged the sweater tighter around my faded jeans. "I was about to open some wine if you wanted to..."
"You would have changed if you'd known I was coming? If you'd known I was coming?"
"Well, yes, I would have put on..."
"Check your phone."
"My phone?"
"Check it."
"Oh, I see. You did call?"
"Twice in the past hour, to ask if I could take you to dinner tonight." "Caroline, I swear to God, maybe we should switch to a more modern, reliable form of communication. Say, carrier pigeons?"
All right, I'm sorry."
"Or maybe smoke signals?"
"It's because I turn the ringer off when I'm in class, and then I always forget to..."
"What about Morse code? That could be fun."
He was starting to smile.
"Or semaphore flags, the yellow and red ones, like they used to wave to signal trains. Doesn't the Navy still use them on ships?"
"I'm about to slam this door on you. Get in here before I whack a semaphore flag over your head." I reached for his jacket, grabbed the edge of a pocket, and pulled him in. It was dark in the hall after I shut the door against the street light. An October chill rose off his clothes, and I caught his scent, the now familiar mix of soap and maybe a warm animal waiting at home. I thought he might kiss me, and I felt suddenly, unexpectedly shy. Instead, Will bent down and pressed his forehead to mine.
"I've been trying to give you your space," he whispered. "I know you needed to spend the weekend alone, but I've been going crazy wanting to see you."
We stood there, heads touching, not speaking, until my breath slowed to match his own. His fingers brushed mine in the dark. Then his hand climbed my arm, circled it, teasing, lingering in the velvety crook of my elbow. It took Will 100 years to reach my shoulder, to stroke my throat, to round my chin, his thumb, the thick pad of it, on my mouth, pressing, bruising, my lips swelling under his touch. I began to shake.
"Beautiful girl," he whispered.
For a man who was not my type, Will Zartman was definitely growing on me.
25. Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013. Word of my possible inheritance came before breakfast.
"Good morning," trilled Jessica Yao. "Are you awake? Got a minute?"
"Sure, just making toast." She had, in fact, caught me cracking eggs for an omelet that I was planning to stuff with chorizo. Will and I had never gotten around to dinner last night. We'd found too many other ways to pass the time. When I woke, he was already gone.
You're up early. Already at work?
God, no. You've clearly never worked in a newsroom. Nobody shows up before 10. It's like some unspoken but unanimous pact among the reporters.
She giggled.
I have got your article open on my laptop, though. It looks good.
My article? You mean the follow-up that Leland Brett was writing? It's already finished?
It's on the front of today's Metro section. He might be a horny old bugger, but he writes fast.
Jessica?
Sorry, but I speak the truth. Both about Leland being a horn dog and about the story looking good.
She blew her nose loudly.
Excuse me. It sounds like your parents were really nice folks. Ever since the first article ran last week, people have been calling the paper to say kind things about them and to wish you well. Leland quotes a bunch of them in today's story.
He told me he was planning to. I'll take a look when we hang up.
Cool. Anyway, a couple of developments. I've been following the money. Your money.
Not my money.
My birth parents' money. Whatever there was of it. Kind of fascinating, actually. The cemetery wouldn't tell me anything. Just the date your parents were interred and the location of their graves.
I know. I went out there to take a look.
It was a long shot, but I was hoping your paperwork would still be in a file somewhere, that it might show who paid for their plots, what bank the check was drawn on, that type of thing. It sounds like that stuff got dumped ages ago, though, and it wouldn't be public record anyway. In better news, I'm making progress on Boone and Sadie Rawson's social security numbers.
Yeah, about those. Listen to this, she said, ignoring me.
Officially, it takes weeks to find out a dead person's number. You have to pay $29 and fill out this form. I've got one here. Hang on.
I heard her shuffling papers, then the sound of something heavy, a book, maybe, crashing onto a hard floor.
Damn it! She came back on the line. I need to improve my filing system. Complete chaos. But here we go. Form number 711, request for a deceased individual's social security record. You mail it off, and then you're supposed to wait 4 to 6 weeks for a response.
Jessica,
however, since I am a rock star researcher, she paused theatrically, I think I can get them for you by the end of the week. The stupid public affairs lady gave me this lecture about how it's impossible to expedite a search, and how I had to wait my turn, and blah, blah, blah. But I went over her head, and
I already found them.
You what?
I found the numbers. On Ancestry.com.
Really?
Jessica sounded stunned.
Everyone's social security numbers are just sitting there?
Well, at least dead people's are. My parents popped right up. You could have found them yourself in 5 minutes. The Social Security Administration keeps something called the Death Master File. Grim name, but useful. It lists everybody whose deaths were reported to the government all the way back to 1875.
Jeez, I feel like an idiot.
Not at all. I had time on my hands over the weekend. I pulled up the state records, too. Every death recorded by the Georgia Health Department from 1919 to 1998. I already ordered copies of their original death certificates.
Great, said Jessica, sounding deflated.
There is one thing I can't do from here, though.
The property records, right?
She perked up.
I was getting to that. It's taken me a few days because I can't search online. The database only goes back to 1980. But so far, lunch today is looking quiet, so I was going to drive down to Fulton County Courthouse. Apparently, they keep books, I mean, actual books, in the deeds and records room.
And the books would show what? Who bought my parents' house? The purchase price?
The deed itself. Who sold the house on your parents' behalf, I'm hoping. I've got the lot number on Eulalia Road, so that should be easy.
She clapped her hands.
While I'm there, guess where else I was going to go?
No idea.
Probate court, she crowed with improbable delight. It's right there in the same government complex. If your parents had a will, and let's assume they were organized, responsible citizens, and that they did, it should be filed there.
and Will's are public record. Isn't that cool? We can just walk in and ask to see them. I learned that yesterday from one of the political editors.
I set down my mug of tea on the counter and considered this. I would have thought that Will's were private. I mean, mine certainly is. A stranger couldn't stroll into some government office and browse through it.
Right, but you're not dead, are you? Your will hasn't been probated.
Okay, but surely even dead people have some right to...
Nope. The dead have no rights and can suffer no wrongs, recited Jessica. I'm quoting. Oh, what was his name? Some English judge. They taught us all this in journalism school. How you can't libel a dead man.
Huh. But you can read his will.
Exactly.
Well, if you're right, if we really can read Bood and Sadie Rawson's wills, we might be able to figure out what happened to the house, and why nothing ever passed to me.
If we can get our hands on your parents' wills, then we might be in business.
The next time my phone rang, the conversation was more tense.
You need to stop talking to the press, ordered Beamer Beasley. Next time that Leland Brett calls, you tell him bye-bye and send him straight to me.
With pleasure, but why? Did I do something wrong?
No, ma'am. It's a nice story in the paper this morning. But from a police point of view, it's time to shut down the conversation. The press has served its purpose.
If it weren't for the press, you wouldn't have known about my coming back to Atlanta.
That's true. I don't deny a little media coverage can work wonders. Helps jog people's memories, for one. But you also got to remember, whatever gets printed, it's out there for anyone to read. So information about evidence might be best kept to yourself.
You mean I should shut up about the bullet and my plans to get it removed?
I mean exactly what I said. Information about evidence might be best kept to yourself.
Speaking of which, there's something I should mention. Beasley listened while I described the disappearance of my chart from Dr. Gellert's office.
I don't know what to make of that,
he said when I was done.
Could be something, could be nothing. But I'm sure it's occurred to you, as it has to me, that the bullet in your neck might be of interest to any number of people. So be smart. Keep your doors locked. Don't open up to anyone you don't know. Don't go out on your own if you can help it.
He hesitated.
I suppose this would be an opportune moment to tell you that your case here is being officially reopened.
No, really?
That's another thing the press is good for, putting pressure on us. Between those news stories and the possibility of new physical evidence, it was inevitable. The decision's already made. They want to go back over all the old files.
My God. I tightened my grip on the phone.
We'd also like to do a formal interview with you, just to set down for the record some of the things you and I have already gone over. If you like, I'll sit in on that.
It won't be you asking the questions, though?
Likely it'll be the current head of the cold case squad. He's good. You want a young guy. It's been a while since I led an investigation. I've been part-time for years now. But given my history with the case and the fact that I already made contact with you, I've agreed to work this full-time. See if I can spot anything the young guys miss.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm glad, too. But let me say it again. Don't get your hopes up. Please. All this means is me and a couple junior detectives will reread the old folders. The answer wasn't in them 34 years ago, and personally, I doubt it is now.
But you said yourself there's new evidence. If the bullet in my neck...
If the bullet in your neck comes out intact, and if the techs can do anything with it, then we might have ourselves a lead. But let's cross that bridge when we get there. All right?
All right.
Deep breath.
All right.
Ms. Cashin, he said in a gentler tone, chances are whoever killed your parents is dead himself by now.
I know. You must think there's a chance of solving it, though, or you wouldn't be taking this on. After a moment's hesitation, Beasley said,
let me answer that indirectly. This past spring, we charged a guy named Daniel Wade with rape. Actually, 5 rapes. Possible ties to 24 more. He was known as the maintenance man because he attacked women in their apartments, pretended to be there to do repair work. One lady he poured water under her front door. Then he knocked and told her he was checking on a leak.
That's awful.
It is. What's interesting is these rapes were committed nearly 30 years ago, back in the mid-80s. Not quite as long ago as your case, but close.
What changed? Why charge him now?
DNA evidence. There wasn't a national database 30 years ago. DNA from the rape kits of several victims indicated it was the same guy. But we only had his DNA profile, not his name. In May, Wade popped up as a match.
So you've arrested him?
No need,
Beasley said wearily.
He's already in federal prison in Kentucky, locked up on unrelated robbery charges until at least 2021. After that, we'll aim to extradite him back down to Georgia.
I was quiet.
Not a fairy tale ending by any stretch. But I raise it because at least those victims get some closure after all these years.
Closure. I rolled the word around on my tongue. No disrespect to those women, who I'm sure went through a horrible experience. But I don't know that there is such a thing as closure. Not in a case like mine. My parents were murdered, right in front of me. My voice cracked. Even in the 1 in 1,000 chance that somehow, after all this time, you could find the man who killed them, it won't bring them back.
Course not. No power on this earth's gonna bring back your family. But you're confusing 2 things. Closure isn't about raising the dead. It's about providing the victim with a sense that justice has been served.
I guess. Beasley heaved a heavy sigh.
I know it comes too late, and that it's not enough. But in a case like that, in a case like yours, that's what we aim for now. Justice.
26. Jessica Yao hit pay dirt at the Fulton County Courthouse. She dug out the deeds for the house on Eulalia Road within 10 minutes. They showed that my birth parents had bought the house for $45,300 in 1975. It had sold 4 years later in December of 1979 for $99,500. A tidy profit back then, especially for a young couple barely out of college. I felt a stab of pride for them. They had been on their way to building a comfortable life for our family before it had all been snatched away. Boone and Sadie Rawson's wills had proven equally easy to lay hands on. The clerks in the records room had needed only their full names and the year they had died. Bingo! Said Jessica when she reached me that afternoon. Guess what I'm holding in my hot little hands? All freshly photocopied and stapled. They've got all the wills lined up on open shelves, just sitting there in white plastic binders. The wills were straightforward, 2 pages each. There were no complicated assets to dispose of. The documents were mirror images of each other. Boone left everything to Sadie Rawson. She left everything to him. Should they not survive each other, then their daughter, Caroline Smith,
was to be the sole beneficiary of their estate. My breath caught. So strange to hear my name rising up from pages drafted decades ago by two people I had loved and then forgotten. I had Jessica read my father's entire will out loud down the phone line. Three details stood out. The first was the name of the executor of my parents' estate, the person they had entrusted to carry out their wishes. They had both named the same man, Mr. Everett A. Sutherland of Charlotte, North Carolina. I had never heard of him. The second was a savings account number. The third, intriguingly, was a reference to a safe deposit box. Both the box and the savings account were held somewhere called Trust Company of Georgia. Trust Company? I asked. Is it headquartered in Atlanta? It was. Come to think of it, maybe it still is. But it's like all the big southern banks, lots of mergers and name changes over the years. I did some research right before I called you. Trust Company of Georgia merged with a Florida bank back in 1985. Then they acquired a bank in Tennessee, and then other assets. They all consolidated, changed their names to Sun Trust in the mid-1990s. Oh, we have Sun Trust banks here in Washington. There's one inside Safeway, my grocery store. I tried to clamp down my excitement. I wonder, I guess we can just call them, right? Find whoever would know where old records are kept for dormant accounts? Yeah, I don't know how complicated that process is. I'm guessing they'll need to see the wills and maybe your parents' death certificates and any other documents we can dig out. As for the safe deposit box, that's interesting. I don't know what physically would have happened to it after 34 years of inactivity, like whether the bank would be required to hang on to it or what. No idea. I'll make a call to Sun Trust, see what I can ferret out. Oh, I can do that. I'm having fun. Jessica was breathing faster, as if she had started walking. I've got to race back to my office, show my face, since this has been, like, the longest lunch break ever. Tonight, though, I'll nose around. See what I can find out about this Mr. Sutherland, the executor. But I was starting to question the wisdom of our arrangement. Thanks for the offer. You've been amazing, really. But I'm thinking I should take it from here. Why? She sounded hurt. Because you're a journalist, and I seem to keep ending up a story in your newspaper. But that's Leland's doing. You're paying me off the books. I know. But what if you dig up something newsworthy? What if... I mean, this is incredibly unlikely, but what if you discovered that my parents left me $1 million... Wouldn't you have an ethical obligation to report that to Leland? As you say, that's incredibly unlikely. But you're a terrific researcher, and I'm betting you dig up something. And whatever it is, whatever is out there to be found, I don't want it in the paper anymore. Why don't you email me copies of everything you've turned up? And tell you what, I teased her, if I stumble into a fortune of $1 million... I'll split it with you. As I was closing my bedroom curtains that night, a car caught my eye. A compact gray car, parked diagonally across the street from my house. Nothing remarkable about that, other than I'd never seen it before. I knew most of my neighbor's vehicles by sight, and we lived far enough up the hill from Georgetown's restaurants and shops that few tourists parked on the block. Inside the car, the outline of his head lit by the tiny screen of his cell phone, sat a man. Again, nothing remarkable there. He could be waiting for someone or killing time until he had to be somewhere. Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have given him a second thought. But Beasley had spooked me. I went back downstairs and double-checked the locks on my doors and windows before crawling into bed to read. Around 11, when I rose to turn off the lights, I peeked out. The gray car was still there. Inside, the man was still sitting.
His phone was switched off now, and I could make out no distinguishing features other than a head of dark hair. I could not see his eyes, only that his face, a pale smear beneath the streetlights, had been turned in the direction of my front door all evening long. 27. Wednesday, October 23rd, 2013. In the morning, I was awakened by an insistent knocking. I ignored it. It came again. I opened an eye. The sun was up. My bedside clock read 7:49. Too early for a package to be delivered. Definitely too early for a friend to stop by. Who then? Beasley's admonition to be careful ran through my mind. Bang, 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 bang! I pushed back the covers and padded to the window, cracked the curtains and squinted down. No. Surely not. I rubbed my eyes. Madame Aubuchon was standing on my front step. She was alone, and at her feet rested what appeared to be a large pot. On her hands, she wore chunky, garishly colored gloves. She must have sensed me staring, for she looked up, shielded her eyes from the sun, and waved. I glanced across the street. The gray car was gone. When I opened the door, she hoisted the pot and held it out in front of her, stooping slightly against its weight. Steam curled from under the shiny lid. The gloves were not gloves at all, but oversized, crudely knitted green and purple oven mitts. They clashed against the soft rose silk of her suit. Hélène? What on earth? Bonjour, Caroline. Ça va? Are you well? Here, take this. She thrust the pot at me. I tried to lift it from her outstretched arms, but pain shot through my right wrist. She noticed me blanch. Je m'excuse. Elle est où ta cuisine? She marched past me toward the kitchen. I trailed behind. I had not expected my premonition to come true quite this quickly. Here I was, groggy and rumpled and still in my nightgown, and here was Madame Aubuchon, charging into my kitchen, dressed as if she were headed next to high tea at the Ritz. You can keep the pot, she was saying, but my grandsons made these. She tucked the cartoon pot holders away into a Cartier bag. Hélène, I pointed at the humongous pot now resting on my stove. What is this?
Bouillon de poulet.
Chicken soup.
Properly made with plenty of garlic and white wine. It needs to cool. Do you have Tupperware?
Without asking permission, she opened a cupboard, peered inside. I nodded, mute. I have spoken French as fluently as English since high school, more than half my life. But it was so bizarre, the sight of her rooting around my cabinets in search of stackable plastic bowls, that words failed me in both languages.
J'en ai fait une quantité énorme.
I made a huge batch.
So you would have enough to freeze and warm every day, while you rebuild your strength.
She banged shut a cupboard door, apparently abandoning the Tupperware quest, and studied me.
Caroline, forgive me, but you look dreadful. Je dormais,
I protested.
I was sleeping. It's important to keep up your routine, she scolded. Do your hair, put on your makeup, get out of the house. It helps when you're depressed.
I'm not depressed. Not that it would be any of her business if I were. And I'll get dressed in a minute. It's barely 8 o'clock. Harsh morning light slanted through the window above the sink. The scent of garlic mixed with chicken grease filled the air between us. It must have been seeping into the curtains, the dish towels, my hair. She was right about one thing. I would need both a shower and a generous spritz of perfume before I would be fit to leave the house. My manners kicked in. You're thoughtful to drop by.
Merci bien.
Thanks so much for the soup. Would you care for a cup of tea?
Non, merci. I'm running late. But allow me to make one other suggestion.
It was tempting to point out that she had forfeited the right to make suggestions for the rest of the semester, but I held my tongue.
Paris, said Madame Aubuchon. Once you're well enough to travel, you should go to Paris. A change of scene would do you good. Don't you think? You may use my apartment.
That's very kind. I couldn't possibly accept.
Pourquoi pas? Don't be so damn polite. Jean-Pierre and I won't get there again until spring. It's near the Bois de Boulogne, dans le 16e.
Of course it was. Paris's 16th arrondissement is where people live when they have plenty of money and no interest in being hip. It's the equivalent of the Upper East Side in New York, or Mayfair in London. She air-kissed my cheeks twice and turned to leave. The next time I stop by, I bit my lip to avoid groaning out loud. The next time? I'll bring you a set of keys. Use them or not, as you wish. I brought extra, said Tony, barreling through my front door with his tie flung over his shoulder and 4 6-packs of beer under his arms. For the second time today, I stood aside and watched someone cart provisions into my house. I know it'll be tough for you to get to the store after the surgery, my brother called over his shoulder. This way, you're fully stocked. I followed him into the kitchen. Thanks, but I don't drink beer. Yeah, I know. One of many areas in which you do persist in demonstrating bad taste. He yanked open my refrigerator door and began whipping bottles of Brooklyn Lager out of their cardboard carriers, then dumping them into the empty produce drawers. These aren't for you, though. They're for Martin and me. So we'll have something decent to drink when we come visit you in your sick bed. I burst out laughing. How considerate. Don't mention it. You can pay me back later. You're too kind. I know. My chivalry knows no limits. I was also thinking, ugh. Tony inhaled, wrinkled his nose in distaste. What are you doing in here, sis? Warding off vampires? Your house reeks of garlic. Damn it. I lit another scented candle. I'd spent half an hour this morning digging out Tupperware and Ziploc bags and transferring the contents of Madame Aubuchon's enormous vat, ladle by ladle, into my freezer. There was enough soup to last me weeks. Somehow I've got to get rid of that smell before tonight. Why? What's happening tonight?
I've got a date. I'm cooking.
My brother heaved himself up to perch on my countertop and sniffed again. I hope that's not what's for dinner. I glowered at him.
Actually, I'm serving steaks. I bought 2.
Hint taken. Don't worry, I'll scram. He sat swinging his legs, rubbing scuff marks from the heels of his black dress shoes onto the pale wood of my cabinet door. He knew this drove me crazy. He knew that I would leap to scrub off the marks the minute he exited the room. He also knew I would never give him the satisfaction of asking him to stop. I pointedly fixed my eyes on the ceiling away from his feet. He pointedly kicked faster. Honestly, sometimes we behave exactly as if we were still 10 years old. Anyway, kick, kick. How are you holding up?
I'm fine. Fabulous.
Seriously.
The kicking slowed.
You've had a hellish week.
I blew the hair out of my eyes. That I certainly have.
The surgery is a definite go? 1 week from today?
Yes.
Sis, anything I can do to help?
I met his gaze. There was no longer any trace of mischief. Nothing but love in his eyes. I don't know. I may need your help eventually with some of the crazy stuff I turned up in Georgia. I'm not quite sure where things are going to end up.
What things? What crazy stuff?
I had not yet confided in my family that the police were reopening their inquiry into Boud and Sadie Rawson's murders. There seemed no point in prompting alarm when it would likely come to nothing. I had resolved to follow Beasley's advice. Lie low,
Don't get my hopes up. Let the investigation run its course. I waved my hand dismissively. Doesn't matter. I think the key thing for the moment will be to get this operation over with, and then to get well. Knock on wood. I glanced around, spotted a wooden salad bowl, wrapped it twice for luck. And after that, I need to keep busy. I'm thinking I'll write a book.
Why not?
I should already have one under my belt, at this point in an academic career, if I ever want to get tenure. I wrote a paper this fall on the politics of divorce in working-class post-Napoleonic France. It was well-received. I could easily expand it. He scratched the stubble on his cheeks. The glint was back in his eye. What? I demanded.
Nothing. I mean, obviously, the world's been waiting for that book. I'm thinking huge initial print run.
The intended audience would be other academics, you cretin. I didn't say it would be a page-turner.
No, don't undersell yourself. That's got bestseller written all over it.
I threw a tea towel at him. You are such an obnoxious ass. He grinned, hopped off the counter, and wrapped me in a fierce hug. Then, without prompting, he grabbed a wad of paper towels and kneeled to polish the marks off the cabinet door. I was watching him in amusement when the doorbell rang. Tony and Will Zartman got on like a house on fire. This irritated but did not surprise me. I perched on the end of the sofa, sipping white wine, while my brother and Will clinked beers and conversed in a language as impenetrable to me as Swahili.
I can't help thinking the DH situation is going to screw the socks, said Tony, his eyes glued to the television screen. Because if they want to use Ortiz, they'll have to take Napoli out of the lineup.
That'll hurt, Will agreed. And getting Alan Craig back, that could be huge for the cards.
I don't know. Do you really think he's their best clutch?
Are you kidding? Craig on a good day.
What's the DH situation? I cut in. If I was going to have to sit through this, I was damn well going to participate.
Designated hitter, said Will, patting my leg.
And what's that?
What's what? A designated hitter?
His expression suggested this was the equivalent of asking, what was a sandwich? Or what was the sky? As in, a concept so basic he'd never had to explain it before.
He turned to Tony.
I promised to teach her about baseball, how the rules work and everything. Good luck with that.
My brother smiled in a way that conveyed he grasped the futility of Will's project at a level Will had not even begun to understand. I ignored them. We sat watching. After a minute, I ventured, what's with the Boston players? Why do they all have beards?
Tribal thing. Team solidarity, said Will.
Tony nodded.
I read that Napoli's is so bushy now he has to use shampoo and conditioner on it. Whereas the cards pitchers might be too young to grow facial hair. Ha, probably true. But could you believe the fastballs that Waka was throwing the other night?
And they were off again, yammering away in Swahili. As the third inning wound down, after I had fixed my brother with an evil stare and made a pointed comment about how both stakes, all two of them, were nearly ready, Tony finally stood to leave. At the front door, he leaned close and whispered,
"Great guy."
"Thanks."
"Not your type, though. He's disturbingly normal."
"Shh. You're just worried that you won't have an excuse to bust out your sprockets routine at Thanksgiving."
"Oh, I'll find a way to work it in."
Tony studied my face.
"Look, I have no interest in your sex life, but is he likely to stay over tonight?"
"Tony, that is so none of your—"
"I'm just thinking you shouldn't be alone. If he's not staying, I could swing back by later tonight. Give you a lift up to Mom and Dad's."
"What? Why?"
"Because I'm worried about you. I can tell you're in pain. And I didn't like that reference you made earlier to crazy stuff you turned up in Georgia.
Tomorrow you're going to tell me what you meant by that.
Despite myself, I glanced over my brother's shoulder. The street was quiet, no gray car in sight. Sure, I promise. I need to get back inside.
So? Tony inclined his head toward where Will sat in my living room.
For God's sake, he's staying. Now good night, you.
I shoved my brother out the door, smoothed my hair. It occurred to me that I must really like Will. I couldn't wait to get back to the sofa, snuggle in, and listen to him hold forth about baseball. But in my absence, Will's mood seemed to have darkened. At first, I assumed he was annoyed that I'd stood whispering with Tony on the front step for so long. Will shook his head no when I dangled another beer. He didn't lift a finger to help as I made up plates and carried them through from the kitchen. I plopped down beside him.
What's up?
Nothing. He fake-smiled at me, then returned to staring at the screen. For the next hour, we sat on the sofa like strangers, not snuggling, not even touching, politely chewing and swallowing steak and salad. Every few minutes he offered a point of incomprehensible sports commentary, and I pretended to sound interested. We spoke less and less as the game ground on. Eventually, I'd had enough. I laid my hand on his.
You okay?
Me? Yes. Bit tired. I should get going.
He should get going? This was not the way I had envisioned the evening unfolding.
Thank you for cooking. He stood up. Delicious marinade on the beef.
Will, what is it? What's wrong?
Nothing. Nothing. Sorry.
Then why won't you look me in the eye?
He did then, miserably. Caroline, I don't know how to...
Just say it.
I'm an idiot. You are amazing. I just... You and me, this is a mistake. I'm your doctor. I should never...
Ah, so that was it. It's okay. I've been thinking about it, too, the ethics of our situation.
He looked stricken. You have?
I'm guessing doctor-patient sexual relationships aren't exactly smiled on in the medical profession.
A pause. No, they're not.
But we're grown-ups, and this is consensual. The situation is what it is. I don't want to presume anything, but... If this is something we both want to continue after my surgery, then I'll just switch doctors. Et voila, no more conflict of interest.
Caroline.
And I promise not to subject you to my stupid brother again until we've had a chance to figure out where things between us stand.
This drew a small smile. I liked him, actually.
He liked you, too. Now stop talking about Tony and kiss me.
I would love to, but I need to go home.
Will shook himself, a forceful, involuntary movement, the way a dog shakes dry after a swim.
I'm sorry everything's gotten confused.
What are you talking about? Everything's gotten confused, as you put it, because you chased me down to Atlanta. Are you now professing that your interest was purely medical?
He bowed his head. No.
I gaped at him in fury and bewilderment. So did you come over here tonight as my doctor, or what? I sputtered. Is this your thing? Are you in the habit of seducing all your female patients?
Whoa. No, Jesus. This has never happened before. It won't happen again.
Shit.
I never curse. Madame Aubuchon must have been rubbing off on me.
Shit! Will, wait!
But he was already striding out of the house, the door slamming shut behind him.
28. They say we are born with 5 basic senses. Remember, you learn this as a child from picture books.
What does the bunny see? What does the bunny smell? And so on. Sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing. 5. But some people have more. Some people can sense when rain is coming. Some mothers of soldiers swear they sensed a chill, an arrow of foreboding, hours before the telegram bearing the unthinkable news arrived. I believe them. There are bonds that surpass the capacity of modern science to explain. Then there are the curious solutions that nature devises to counter a deficit. My great-aunt, deaf from childhood, could sense vibrations, could determine the location of a sound through her feet. She would curl her toes, bony and freckled, onto the warped boards of her front porch. Then she'd jerk upright and point, a full 30 seconds before the rest of us heard the mail truck rumbling up the drive. One sense falters, the others sharpen. So it is at night. At night, it is the sense of sound that will save you. By which I mean, you could not see the man's shadow outside, waiting. Could not touch it as it slipped to the back cellar window, where the black was absolute, where the moonlight did not reach. You could not smell his fingertips as they closed around the doorknob. Could not taste his sweat, beating, salty, and glistening under wool. No. But you could hear the glass shatter. You could hear the bolt scrape as it slid back. Hear the floorboard creak, protesting the weight of the foot that should not have been there. I was asleep when he came. At first, I thought it might be Will returning. Will, having turned around, having decided he wanted to stay the night after all. I lay suspended, halfway between dreaming and awake. My pillow was warm. I would make him apologize. He would have to grovel. Then I would scoot over, let him slip naked between the sheets, let him curl against me. I made a purring sound, turned beneath the blankets. Hurry up, silly boy. What was taking him so long? Why had he made such a clatter letting himself in? Why was he not padding up the stairs? And something else was nagging, some detail not right, swooping and buzzing at my sleepy brain like an insistent insect. At last, I caught it. Will did not have a key. Will could not be in my kitchen. I sat up, listened. I had imagined this moment. Every woman who lives alone must harbor her own private night terrors. In my nightmares, these confrontations always unfold in black and white, grainy like a Hitchcock movie. Me, willowy and bearing a distinct resemblance to Ingrid Bergman, my floor-length white satin dressing gown cinched in a bow around my waist. Something, not a specific noise, so much as a nameless but urgent sense of menace, routs me from bed. I slide on fur-trimmed, kitten-heeled mules and light a cigarette. Still channeling Ingrid here. Inhale for courage. Then Ingrid slash I crack my bedroom door, flick on the hall light, tiptoe to the landing, and call down in a throaty, trembling voice. The trembling voice is key. Is anyone there? Around this point in the dream, I usually snap awake. I never see the intruder's face. The reality, when it came, was less elegant. My hair entangles, my breath sour from last night's wine. In reality, there was no time to tiptoe. Certainly no time to light up a smoke. And no power on this earth that would tempt me from the safety of my bedroom toward the yawning, dark mouth of the stairs. From below, a thump. Someone unfamiliar with my house, bumping softly against a table or chair. Someone moving in the living room. Out of my bed, cross the room, slam the door, turn the lock. But the lock on my bedroom door was useless, flimsy, the keyless kind that spins inside the door handle.
A determined child with a paperclip could pick it in 10 seconds flat. Something to brace the door, then. Against one wall leaned an antique mahogany chest of drawers stuffed with jeans and sweaters. My house was built a century before people decided they needed closets. I leaned in and shoved, tripped, no traction on the waxy floor. Under the bed were a grotty pair of Uggs, suede ankle boots, the ones I wore to bring in the newspaper and roll out my trash bin. Yanked them on. Hurry up. Push. The chest gouging tracks into the floor. There. The chest was square against the door. I pricked my ears. All was still. Nothing but the wind rustling leaves outside my window. My heart slamming in my chest. Whoever was downstairs did not want to be heard. Adrenaline shook my hands as I cast about for my cell phone. Please, God, let me have carried it upstairs last night. Not on my desk, not on the nightstand. I found it in the pocket of my jeans, slung over the back of a chair. My fingers would not cooperate, kept mashing wrong buttons, backing up, fumbling. Finally, ringing. A second went by. Two. Enough time to curse the burglar alarm panel, winking green on the wall, mocking me. I had been so upset after the fight with Will that I'd stormed off to bed without remembering to turn it on. The 911 operator was calm, told me to slow down and repeat my address. I tried, croaked out my cross street, spelled my name, C-A-S-H-I. I was spelling when the stairs creaked, specifically the second stair, then the fourth. I know every loose board. Whoever was climbing was taking the stairs two at a time and stepping smack in the center, not sticking to the quieter, more stable edges. Whoever was climbing no longer cared if he was heard. He's upstairs, I whimpered into the phone. Please hurry. How long?
Ma'am, an officer will be right with...
No, now. You need to get here, now. I threw the phone down, trained my eyes on the crack at the bottom of my bedroom door. The intruder did not turn on a light. On the top step, he seemed to hesitate. Then he began moving toward my closed door. He was panting, winded from the stairs, no more than 12 feet from me. Only the door and that chest of drawers separating us. I could whisper and he would hear every word. My doorknob rattled. He was testing it. He would give up, turn around now, surely. He would not break the lock. This was not personal. 12 burglaries occur every night of the week in the District of Columbia. He would grab whatever burglars come to grab. A camera, my laptop, an expensive and never used tennis racket. And then he would go back to wherever he had come from. Another creak. Retreating footsteps. He had turned around, was tracking back down the hall away from me. I slumped. Air slammed into my chest, sweet air, as though I were surfacing after a long time underwater. I had not realized I'd been holding my breath. Then the crash. The deafening, savage, booming crash of a man running at the door, lowering his shoulder, trying to break it in. Oh, sweet Jesus. There was only one other way out. My bedroom window looks onto the street. The drop is maybe 10 feet, maybe more, onto scrubby azalea bushes and brick sidewalk. I undid the latch, pushed up the window, leaned out and howled, "Help! Help me!" No one below. The street deserted. Behind me, the sound of wood splintering. One leg over the sill, then the other, trying to lower myself, but I had no upper body strength. I'd never done a pull-up in my life. My nightgown snagged. I ripped it free and crashed to the ground. Sting of cold on my skin, scrape of knees against brick, pain beyond words in my neck. I scrambled upright, swayed, stumbled. My right arm, the bad one, instinctively mashing down my breasts, stopping them from swinging unsupported under my gown. Running. Really running. Lungs burning, legs churning, too frightened to stop and look back. It turned out I have been running my whole life. I just never knew it. 29. Thursday, October 24th, 2013. They fingerprinted the entire house before they let me back inside. A frizzy-haired, wide-assed woman around my age arrived with a forensics kit and set to work on the front door. I watched her from the back seat of a squad car, a bulky Georgetown University Police Department jacket draped around my shoulders, another one covering my legs. Blue lights mounted on the car roof flashed on-off in jerky rhythm. I had run straight for the front gates of the university. At the corner of 37th and O Streets, there's always a police car parked, standing by for emergencies and also as a visible reminder of the security presence on campus. I caught the startled look of the officer in the driver's seat as I hurtled in his direction. University cops must see some weird stuff, but hysterical women in UGG boots and torn nightgowns, blood streaming from both knees, probably didn't come along every night. I flew into his arms while he was still disentangling himself from the car, one boot planted on the asphalt, the other midair. Both a gun and a truncheon dangled from his belt. I'd never been so happy to see weapons. The cop half-walked, half-dragged me into the guard station attached to the gates, a stone hut I'd marched past 1,000 times and never given a second glance. He sat me down, offered a tissue, and motioned for me to wipe the snot and tears off my face. It was still dark outside. I had no idea what time it might be.
"You okay, ma'am? You hurt?"
"There was a man," I gasped.
"Okay, you're okay now. Deep breaths."
In my house."
"And where's that?"
"Q Street."
"Q Street? All right. Take it easy. There you go."
My teeth were chattering so violently it must have been audible. He snatched a Navy police jacket off a hook and wrapped it awkwardly around me.
"So, this guy in your house, you know him?"
Did I know him? But it was a logical question. Women who turn up bloody and weeping in the wee hours must often turn out to be domestic violence victims, their wounds inflicted by their husbands or boyfriends.
"No."
I shook my head for emphasis, and the simple gesture scorched such pain through me that my vision went white. Pinpricks of light danced behind my eyelids. When I forced them open, the cop had folded his arms over his gut and was regarding me with an expression somewhere between pity and wariness. I must have looked frightful, like a mad woman off her meds. Snarled hair, skinned knees, mangy boots. The hem of my nightgown ripped and dirty. Embarrassment spurred me to pull rank. "My name is Caroline Cashin. Professor Cashin, I'm faculty."
"Really?"
"French department. Faculty of Languages and Linguistics."
His eyebrows bounced up.
Then, recovering,
"Professor, okay, I didn't... Hang on."
He reached behind him, felt around on the counter for a spiral-bound notebook.
"Let me take down your address. Call this in."
"I already called it in," I snapped. "I called 911 from my house, but the guy who I don't know, the burglar, he was inside. He came upstairs. I had to run." The cop was nodding, scribbling, a new urgency to his movements, when the hut door slammed open. I jumped, ready to flee, but it was only another uniformed police officer. Flabby, older than the first.
"Evening, Al. Goddamn freezing out."
He spotted me, checked himself.
"Evening, miss."
He looked me up and down,
then turned to my cop.
What do we got here? This is, Mrs. Professor Cashin. I was just...
The one apparently named Al had slid out a keyboard from an under-desk tray and was pecking at the keys. I knew what he was searching. I doubted that at that moment I remotely resembled the smiling, poised ID photo that he would pull up in the university database, but the age, race, and gender would match. The photo must have passed muster because the two cops exchanged nervous glances and began barking at each other.
Why haven't you cleaned her up? Where's the first aid kit?
The older one. Al swatted him away.
I'm calling over to Idaho Avenue, see what they know.
Idaho Avenue is the closest D.C. Metropolitan Police Station. Second District, the one responsible for Georgetown.
Here we go. Just a little sting.
The older officer again, leaning over my knees, swiping at them with an antiseptic wipe that stung like hell. He lowered his voice.
Do you need a rape kit?
No, thank God.
You said you called 911. Were they sending somebody over to take a look?
Asked Al, one hand cocked on his hip and the other squeezing the phone to his ear. Before I could answer, he held up a finger and mouthed, "Wait." Then, to the phone,
Georgetown DPS here, main campus. I got a lady here.
Half an hour later, I was back on Q Street, back in front of my house, climbing out of Al's GUPD vehicle, being handed off to a DC police detective. The big boys would take it from here. The sky was beginning to streak gray. My father was on his way. The fingerprint lady had finished out front and moved inside. Al squeezed my shoulder, told me not to worry about the jackets. I could return them any time. Then he was gone, and a new detective stood before me. The new guy was wiry with beady eyes and a thin, rodenty nose that started too high on his forehead. He addressed me with what sounded like a stock speech.
I must be exhausted, but anything I could tell them was helpful, and it was important to do it now while the details were fresh.
My front hall looked just as it always had, every lamp blazing. A shadow moved at the top of the stairs, causing me to shrink back against the front door. But it was only the fingerprint lady, wrapping up, calling down to us,
"All set." "Ready?"
The detective turned to me.
"Ready to show me exactly what happened?"
I told my story. The detective listened, jotted it down in careful block letters, ballpoint pen scratching across a carbon copy form, filling in boxes in smeary pink and yellow triplicate. Hadn't these guys ever heard of iPads? But I sensed he wasn't quite buying it. He kept pressing me on what I had actually seen. Nothing. I'd actually seen nothing. I was behind a locked door the entire time. And what exact noise had awakened me? Maybe glass breaking? Or a creaky floorboard? And what exact time I had heard this alleged noise? 3 a.m.? 4? 5?